Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to the Leaving Eden podcast. We are here with you today. My name's Gavriel Hacohen, and with me, as always, is my best friend and co-host, cult expert, cult survivor, Sadie Carpenter. How's life today, Sadie?
I am doing pretty well. I'm excited to get into this episode.
I am too. This is one. When I was trying to pitch the idea of this episode to Sadie, I'm not sure you were totally sold on this, were you?
No, not quite.
Because doing an episode with the idea of, is consumerism a cult? Like, is consumerism... That seems like something that's hard to define and also hard to prove. So I think that the tack that I want to take is, when does the desire to own things and when does the desire to collect things, worship of brands, and the status that that allots you, can that become something that resembles cult control?
So I think, is consumerism a cult, is a great snappy title for this episode, because can social pressures toward consumerism approach a cult-like amount of control over the consumer? Doesn't quite flow so well.
No.
But that is the question that we're asking. In what ways can this be similar to cult control? The thing that we talk about over and over on this show is how humans are innately tribal and innately impressionable. There are so many different avenues through which a person can attempt to exercise coercive control over someone else. Some of those methods of exercising coercive control have been shown to work over and over and over again. The methods that are the most effective get used the most often. And what that leads to is cults of all varieties using a very similar playbook. So even non-religious cults will often use very similar methods to the best known religious cults. Sleep deprivation is the first one that jumps to my mind. You see that in almost every single cult group, religious, non-religious alike. So talking about these specific methods of coercive control and how they can show up in our daily lives is really valuable, because it would be pretty unlikely for a clothing brand to be a cult. But there could be some small elements of cult control or coercive control coming from a clothing brand or from the community of people who wear that brand. And the more that we can recognize and spotlight these elements of control wherever we see them, the better we can protect ourselves and those around us from cults and cult-like control.
That was very well put. I think that saying consumerism is a cult is the kind of thing that if you say that on the internet, that'll get you a bunch of likes and that'll get you a bunch of upvotes wherever it is that you're saying. I really want to dive into this and look at this seriously. So before we get into that, the Leaving Eden podcast is the podcast about my BFF and co-host, cult expert, cult survivor, Sadie Carpenter, her life in and escape from the Independent Fundamental Baptist cult, which is the cult in which she was raised. We talk about this cult. We talk about other cults. We talk about religion. We talk about fundamentalism. We talk about the real and present threat that cults and cult ideologies pose to society as a whole. And it is our goal to promote freedom of mind, freedom of thought, and freedom of religion. So if you like our show, if you are a fan of our show, there's some things that you can do in order to support us. You can join our Patreon at patreon.com/leavingedenpodcast. You can join our Facebook group and our subreddit. Both of those are called Eden Exodus. Both of those are great places to have discussion. Over the past couple weeks, especially since we've done the I Kissed Aiden Goodbye and the Woman They Wanted episodes, the discussions that have gone on in that group have been really impressing on me and really, you know, been very thoughtful and pretty compassionate to what people have gone through. So if you want to go there and join in that conversation, facebook.com/groups/Eden Exodus, great place. And I think that's it. We just have to thank the patrons. Sadie, do you want to thank the patrons?
I absolutely do. I want to thank the patrons every single day. Our I Gave It All tier patrons are I'm Not 1010, Kathleen Moncrief, Melissa Mosley, wait, Melissa Manown.
Yes, she got married.
Melora King, yeah, and Todd Dale on behalf of his cult survivor wife, Madeline Antrim. Our Faith Promise Missions tier patrons are Allie Allen, Autumn of Our Discontent, Brittany, Chris Walker, Dora J., Eleanor Donahue, Hannah Ross, Hannah Montana, Hope Norum, Horton Hears a Shane, Janine Callen, Jana Connor, Jen Kaharski, Jessica Tambo, Jonna, Kat Hinwood, Kay Terwee, Kristen Marie, Learned Vixen, Linda Morgan, Madeline Antrim, Madeline Cusick, Marlena Stuve, Mary Martin, Megan Arndt, Melissa G., Morgs, Rob the Methodist, Stephanie Johnson, Steve and Amy, Susie, Tara McNamara, and Wes the Cowboy.
Thank you guys so much for supporting us at the Faith Promise Missions and I Gave It All tier of our Patreon.
And thank you to everyone who supports our show, both financially on Patreon and in the many other ways that our listeners support us. You post about us on social media, recommend us to friends and family, download and listen to episodes, and participate in discussions on social media. All of those things benefit us. They help more people find our show, and they continue to give us a platform, and we are so thankful.
Yes, thank you guys so much. Let's do the TW, and then we will be on our way.
Trigger warning for capitalism.
Trigger warning for capitalism for... if you ever worked in marketing, huge TW for that.
In general, we talk about a lot of potentially triggering topics on this show, including but not limited to suicide and mental health, racism, misogyny, PTSD and PTSD symptoms, child abuse, mental, physical, and sexual abuse, and spiritual abuse, including guilt, shame, and fear. In most episodes, we will mention at least a few of these topics, but we avoid graphic detail unless it's relevant to the story that we're telling. And we give our audience a heads up if we are going to include any of that graphic detail.
So we're going to start off this episode. I don't want to assume that everybody understands economics. So I just want to do like a brief refresher on like supply and demand curves, because that's going to be important in this episode.
Okay. Yeah. Some of us were educated by ACE.
Yes. And there is no shame in that if you suffered educational neglect and you learn new stuff every day, even if you did have a good education growing up. So the price of a good, the price of something that you want to buy is controlled by how much of that good that you have, or the supply, and how many people want to buy it, or the demand. If you have a good that is readily available and not a lot of people want to buy it, the price will come down because not as many people are willing to pay as much money for it. If you have a good that it is not readily available and a lot of people want to buy it, then the prices are going to go up because people are going to be willing to pay more money for it. I think that that's simple enough.
Yeah.
The best example for this I can think of is tickets, like concert tickets. So if I'm buying tickets to a sporting event, if I don't think that the sporting event is going to sell out, I'm going to wait until the last minute and then I'm going to buy tickets on the secondary market because I know that people who have tickets and haven't sold them yet are going to try and offload them and make some money back instead of taking a full loss because the value of their good expires once the event starts and because the demand for that good doesn't meet the supply. On the other hand, say I wanted to go see Taylor Swift on the Eras Tour. That is an event where there are more people who want to see Taylor Swift than there are seats in the stadium to see Taylor Swift. And so supply can't keep up with the demand. So people will pay many, many, many times face value in order to get their hands on tickets to see Taylor Swift. So I want to define a term now, and this term is Veblen goods. So a Veblen good is a product that defies the usual rules of supply and demand, because as the price of this good increases, the demand for the good also increases. So the high price is a feature of the good and not a consequence of the quality or the materials or the labor used to produce it. And there are a lot of good examples of Veblen goods, like luxury cars, jewelry, handbags, clothing, things like that. I actually have here linked a New York Times article from 2006, which states that private colleges and universities noticed a serious increase in applicants when they raised their prices and then offered money back in scholarships. And they were basically tricking their applicants into thinking that they were getting a big discount on something more valuable. And then they were able to increase their admissions by hundreds of students.
So I'm glad you defined that, because I was definitely aware of the concept of goods where the high price is a feature, not a bug. But I didn't know that there was a name for it. Also, Fred Meyer keeps trying to do the private college and university scholarship thing to me with meat going on, quote unquote, sale.
It's rude.
They're not counting on me taking notes every time I go shopping.
But yeah, you can see this up market. You can see this down market. It's just like how, I mean, during the pandemic, you know, when there was no supply for anything, people were paying like above sticker for cars and stuff. But it's just like how, oh, they say the MSRP of the car is this, and almost nobody would pay MSRP if you were buying a car prior to that. So anyway, I want to talk about luxury goods now. So the global luxury goods market increased by about 9% between 2022 and 2023 and did more than $1.6 trillion in revenue. Trillion with a T. In the United States, the luxury goods market was worth less than about $90 billion in 1995, and today it is worth more than $350 billion, billion with a B.
Can we talk about how we are defining luxury goods?
Sure.
So I know that it doesn't just mean something that you don't need for your life. I know that it means something a little bit different than that. So I was looking at similar bracelets on the Tiffany website and on the Fred Meyer Jewelers website, and I found pretty similar sterling silver with small diamond silver chunky link bracelets. And the one at Tiffany was $1,500 and the one at Fred Meyer was $500. And it's not just like, a bracelet is not just a luxury good in the terms that we are talking about it for this episode today, simply because it's something you don't need as a necessity for life. But the Tiffany bracelet is luxury because the price is higher than the workmanship and materials. Can you explain how are we defining luxury?
Right. So the technical definition for a luxury good is a good for which the demand rises more than is proportional as income rises. So this is in contrast to like a necessity good, which is something that people keep buying consistently, no matter how much money that you make, you know, like food, gas, paper towel, stuff like that. Fred Meyer jeweler and the Tiffany bracelets are both going to be luxury goods, technically, under the definition of the term. The difference is that the Tiffany one is from a well-known luxury brand, whereas the Fred Meyer one will probably be made by somebody else, and then they'll sell it under the Fred Meyer jeweler name brand. But that doesn't make it not a luxury good.
Okay.
When they're talking about the luxury goods market, they're talking about things like jewelry, luxury cars, like, you know, stuff like that. But whether or not a diamond bracelet is going to be a luxury good, whether or not it's made by Tiffany or Fred Meyer Jewelers.
Okay. So you said luxury cars, and I think that makes a lot more sense, because in many parts of the United States, a car is a necessity item.
Yes.
In some, you know, some cities, it wouldn't be. But in many areas of the U.S., that is a necessity. Having a car that runs at least 99% of the time is an absolute necessity. But having a car with a certain name brand or leather seats or a more expensive car or a newer car or a shinier car is not at all a necessity. So there aren't really like luxury bracelets and non-luxury bracelets, but there are regular cars and luxury cars.
Exactly. You've got it.
I needed that. Thank you.
So I've given the technical definition of a luxury good. And if we're talking about the Tiffany bracelet versus the Fred Meyer jeweler, my opinion is that, like, when we're talking about like what is a luxury brand and what isn't a luxury brand, my opinion is that if a brand has to tell you that it is luxury, then it isn't luxury.
Hmm.
And like a lot of brands will like go out of their way to bill themselves as affordable luxury, which I also like. I just feel like if it's a luxury brand, then like where does that come from? Where does that reputation of being luxury come from?
I think affordable luxury is supposed to mean it's really good quality, but you're not paying for the brand name.
But that also is just like, it's people are just gonna be like, oh, but that's off brand, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
If we're talking off brand and we're talking about, oh, I get my alcohol from the Costco liquor store, then it's totally fine. But if it's like, oh, you're wearing the off brand jewelry, then people are gonna notice. That's the thing.
Yeah, we're gonna get there.
Yeah, we'll get there. So what I find most intriguing is, who is actually buying luxury goods? So you would think it would be rich people, older people, people who have established careers. Like if we think of like, who is a Mercedes driver? You think of somebody, maybe they work in real estate, maybe they're a stockbroker, maybe they're a banker or something like that. But this is not the case. The increase in luxury goods market share over the past 10 years has been largely fueled by millennials and Gen Z, who have notably less money than their parents and grandparents did at their age. Millennials and Gen Z together make up about 2/3 of luxury goods buyers. That statistic flabbergasted me. Most notably, a buyer of luxury goods is about as likely to be low income or middle income as high income. So this is in stark contrast to 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, at which point a purchaser of luxury goods was far less likely to be low income. So there are a lot of contributing factors to this. One is that millennials and Gen Z are more likely to live with their parents than older generations, and living with your parents means that you spend less money on rent or a mortgage, and it also means that you may have more disposable income, which can be spent on luxury goods. Ironically, the crisis in affordable housing is contributing to people spending more money on luxuries, not less.
That's fun.
Yeah. I mean, no, it's funny because you always hear people say, oh, well, you just have to stop eating your avocado toast and then you'll be able to afford a house. And people are like, no, I'm buying avocado toast because I can afford avocado toast, but I can't afford the house. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's just like one example. So another factor is status. That so according to a recent survey from GWI, which is a consumer insights group, more than half of respondents said that they believed people who own high value products are more likely to be respected by others. And in unstable economic conditions, Young heterosexual men often believe that luxury goods will signal financial stability to women that they want to attract. So they're showing extravagance in the face of a culture of belt tightening when, if it was maybe a better economy, owning these sorts of goods would be seen as a sign of irresponsibility rather than like, oh, this man can provide for me. Similarly, that's fun. Similarly, women may believe that showing off extravagant luxury or designer products is beneficial in that it signifies that they are more worth spending money on. Like, we've all seen advertising and marketing that takes the tack of treat yourself because you're worth it. We've all seen ads that say that.
Yeah.
Which, on one hand, like, it's totally okay to spend money on yourself, but there is this other side of it that ties your value as a person to how much money is spent maintaining you as a person.
Yeah, that is disappointingly sexist and heteronormative. Yikes.
Culture and marketing can be pretty disappointing and sexist and heteronormative.
I hope I didn't come off as if I were blaming you. I know that you didn't come up with that.
I didn't invent culture, sadly. If I did, it would have been better. No, I'm
sorry.
I'm glad
I found myself staring off into space, imagining Gavi land. That was both really fun and absolutely terrifying.
It would be ruled by orange cats.
A spider in every Crown Royal bottle.
That's true. Oh God. Oh God.
That's what you call a deep cut.
Deep cut. If you know, you know. I'm actually glad that you brought up heteronormativity because, according to a study that I read, gay men spend more on luxury goods than straight men.
I think gay men spending more on luxury goods makes sense for a couple demographic reasons. And one of them is that gay men are less likely to have children.
That's true.
So they're more likely to be a DINK family, especially like a partnership of two gay men, way more likely to be dinks than a straight couple.
Having a child is like owning an exotic pet. It's like all the people on Tiger King.
You either got to be rich or crazy.
Yeah.
Not rich.
So there is another motivator for a lot of excess spending and luxury goods within the millennial and Gen Z segments. And this is the most fun one. And by fun, I mean not fun at all. And that is the phenomenon of doom spending. You know about doom spending, Sadie?
No, let's hear about it.
Okay, so people who are convinced that they will never live long enough to reach financial solvency are less likely to be motivated to save their money, be frugal, and, you know, make sensible financial decisions, and they're more likely to spend it on short-term luxuries.
Ugh. Yeah, that sounds about right.
I personally could do a whole episode about how I believe that doomerism is just a massive scam because it generates revenue for media companies and convinces people to spend money that they don't have on luxury goods that they don't need because they don't think that they'll ever have to worry about paying it back.
See, I was wondering if that was a potential factor in the luxury goods market during the pandemic. Because you mentioned earlier.
Oh, probably.
Like in these pandemic times, the luxury goods market has increased, you said, 9% between 2022 and 2023.
Yeah, and those years are 22 and 23 are like tail end of the pandemic, end of the pandemic.
I wouldn't say the pandemic is over. It is the end of the pandemic being recognized as a social factor by our government and a large percentage of people. And that's why I don't say like the pandemic is over. I certainly recognize that the way that society as a whole thinks about it, the way the government treats it, is very, very different in 2024 than it was in 2021 when I wore a mask in labor and I will never let anybody forget it. That's like my ultimate martyr moment that I will never quit bragging about and let people forget. But
no, that is a valid point.
Yeah, the way that we treat it is very different now. People are still dying and getting disabled, but it is being treated like any other disease that kills people and disables people. And people who have become disabled with long COVID are being treated like any other person who is disabled.
So to say, not well.
Yep.
The whole idea of doom being a factor between 22 and 23, I don't think it's the same as if we were saying like 20 and 21.
I think I was doom spending in 2020.
Oh, I was too.
Before, and then I got pregnant and thought, oh shoot. So I also wonder, you said that millennials and Gen Zs are doom spending, and I'm not disagreeing with you. I just wonder if it's also a function of being young in general. I'm thinking back to myself as a teenager, or even like 6 or 7 years ago in my early 20s, brands and luxury were way more important to me. At 16, I wouldn't be caught dead in a hoodie that wasn't from either Aeropostale or American Eagle. Like, that's it. And by 24, 25, I had grown out of that. I was buying my hoodies from wherever, but I was still really into luxury purses, certain purse brands, and I was carrying fake luxury purses. I had a fake Dooney & Burke. I had real Coach purses that were factory mistakes because I had a hookup at the Coach factory.
Oh, yeah.
At the outlet store. But I was carrying only luxury bags because I felt like I needed that status symbol. And now at 31, I throw all my stuff and the applesauce for the kid and extra pull-ups into my crappy little Adidas backpack, and it's fine. There are things that I only buy name brand of, but it's really only what I perceive to be quality. If you looked in my cabinets, like 90% of the food in there is store brand, but I won't buy anything but name brand Oreos because store brand Oreos just are not as good. Now, I will use, you know, any old ratty backpack, but I really like a designer wallet. So I just retired my old Coach wallet that I've had for like 9 years, and I got a new Kate Spade one for Christmas. So I've really, in the last, you know, 10 years of my life or so, it has been a dramatic growing out of brands for luxury, like wanting a luxury brand. And the only brand loyalties that have really stuck are the ones that I think my perception of the quality of those things.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair and that's totally accurate. And there's always like the, oh, is this the name brand or is the knockoff like 90% as good? I would never buy Le Creuset at the store because that's so much money. But if I see Le Creuset on Facebook Marketplace for $100, I'm getting it, mm-hmm. You know. But no, for me as well, I did care about like, I mean, even though I was from Portland, Oregon, and I was raised to be an anarchist and believe that capitalism was the great Satan, if I was going to be sticking it to the man, you know that I had to be like jamming out on some tunes on my iPod because I could never, ever, ever be seen rocking a Zune or an iRiver because that would be embarrassing. You got to have the iPod from Apple. And, you know, like I had to have a Motorola Razr Ultra Slim, you know, Ultra. I think my first phone was a Motorola Razr. You have to text the homies on the T9 so that you can meet up and get pizza and then Redbox a payphone to make prank phone calls. That's what I was up to as a young teen. But it was always like, no, you have to have the right brand. Even if you're like, I'm sticking it to the system, you have to have the right brand.
Yeah, you got to listen to your Green Day on proper iPod. Green-
Yeah. No, I mean, it's like the very like pop punk thing, whereas you want to be punk, but you got to be pop doing it. So you have to like fit in with the system by going against the system. These motivations we've talked about, maybe like understandable or at least comprehensible motivations to spend money on luxury goods. I don't think that describing this as like cult control to this point would be accurate or fair to anybody who grew up like Sadie, who grew up under actual cult control. The closest thing that I can say to this is that it's like short of being MLM. Like there are some similarities, but I don't think it comes up to that level. And MLMs, because like in an MLM, if you are somebody who is in one, you get awarded status when you move a large volume of product, whether or not you're actually selling the product or whether you're just purchasing it and keeping it in your garage in order to maintain your Diamond Select Club membership or whatever. Your status in the group spends on how much money you are spending or making the company.
I would be quick to point out that some MLMs absolutely do function as cults. there's a lot of thought control and emotion control in the way that some of them operate. For example, they may tell you if you're not selling enough, that's your stinking thinking, and it's your fault because you don't have the right mindset. I would say many MLM companies, and that's multi-level marketing for the percentage of people we confused, do have some aspects of bite model control, and some do function as cults.
The other thing with MLMs is that there is a formal enforcement status with rules and parameters. So you have to like move a certain number of product a month or a week or a year in order to maintain this status. The question is, how would such a thing be applicable to a non-formalized status of in the world as guy who owns expensive things? So this is a great time for me to talk about the role of social media algorithms in all of this. So social media apps like TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, these are all places where a person's perception of how they are viewed by other people can become very warped, either positively or negatively. So building a large following on social media can garner somebody massive positive attention or massive negative attention. In doing research for this episode, I spoke off the record to a personal friend who runs a somewhat successful YouTube channel about interior design, and he told me that by featuring a large price in either the YouTube thumbnail or in the video caption is almost like a surefire way to get views on your video. So this is also actually one of the reasons why I think Bethany Beale keeps talking about money on her channel. She keeps saying 100K a year, 100K a year, 100K. If you see 100,000, then you're going to like a dollar amount, then you're going to click on that. But what he told me is from his professional perspective, he could put up a video that was titled $500,000 home gets $50,000 kitchen remodel. I'd watch that. Wait, would you watch that? I'd watch that video.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd be a lot more likely to click on that video than I would to click on a video that says Dutch Colonial gets induction stove and ditches formica for black granite countertops. It doesn't have to be a high price. It just kind of has to be any price, just to tell you, like, just because everything is worth money or a lot of things in life cost money, it determines what framework you're looking in. So like, a $500,000 house is a house that, you know, somebody might, I mean, with housing prices what they are right now, somebody might buy a $500,000 house and say, well, this house needs a new kitchen. How much can we spend on the kitchen? And that's a legitimate thing that they might actually want to do. My friend who's making those videos, he does that for work or as like a side income for his job where he is actually an interior designer. If you're a person who was brought up in the information age and one of the main sources of camaraderie of validation that you get from your friends is from social media, then you may get more of that validation if you're like flexing a BMW or like an Hermes clutch or like the tabby boots or like a Rolex than if you're posting pictures of your cat. And I spoke to a friend of mine who formerly worked at Meta, and he told me that Instagram and Facebook's algorithms prioritize these kinds of posts for a couple of reasons. So first, images generate more interaction and get more engagement than text posts. So images, automatically, they're going to get a bump. Second is that all social media platforms primarily make their money off of advertising. And the closer that a regular post from your friend showing off like a new purchase comes to resembling an advertisement from a company, the more likely you are to interact with an advertisement that's on your feed because it looks like the post from your friend.
Oh, that makes sense.
Doesn't it make sense, though?
That was a light bulb moment.
Beyond being algorithmically enforced social clout, there are also entire online communities that are devoted to either luxury goods, brands of luxury goods. And I'm sure that we've all come across this sort of thing. They can range from like forums where people discuss a brand's history, iconic moments, legendary products, things like that. Or it can be a place where people discuss maintenance, modification, buying and selling products, things like that. For example, when I used to be into modifying cars, there were forums set up where people would discuss maintenance and like any problem, any bug, any issue that you had with your car that was like a known reliability issue. There was somebody on there on the internet who had had it before who could say, here's the kit. You buy this kit from this person for $200 and you go in and you do this and you fix it. When I was more into buying and selling guitar gear, there were forums where people would discuss guitar gear. Of course, the common theme on a lot of these forums is that the more money you spend on parts or equipment, the better results you usually have. And some people would find online community in these forums, and they would build kind of their personal identity around being a person who owns or uses a certain good, which was often weird to see because it often felt like an online social club that you had to buy membership into, like you had to pay your way into it.
So this is where I see a real danger for elements of the Byte model to potentially show up. My husband is a guitar guy, so I'm going to go with your example of a guitar gear forum as a place this could potentially show up for my hypothetical example, because I have seen him collect gear, buy and sell gear, and build his pedal board and all of that.
Yeah, I am very familiar with this. I, too, have been on the gear page, and I've been also doing guitar long enough to know that all of the shit sounds exactly the same, and if he ever tells you that he needs a new guitar pedal, he doesn't.
So he runs a very simple pedal board. So simple that I can tell you what everything on the board does.
It's frugal. He doesn't have a crazy board. My board's crazier than his.
Yeah, I think he really tries to resist the needing a new pedal thing.
That's how they get you.
So let's talk about though this like hypothetical guitar forum. If someone wanted a specific brand of pedal, but everybody else had a different brand, and they felt like they wouldn't be cool if they got the cheaper brand or the different brand that they really wanted, sure, that could potentially be behavior control. But we've talked a lot about how behavior control is not a sign of a cult to itself, because almost every group of humans practices some small amount of behavior control. I think information control, thought control, and emotion control could be much more of an issue here. So let's say we're talking about this guitar gear pedal board group somewhere on social media. If someone uses a pedal on their board that is considered bad or subpar by the group, and they say that their rig sounds good to them, they like how it sounds, group members might jump in and say, no, it doesn't sound good, or that can't possibly sound good. So that would be both gaslighting and information control, because they're both gaslighting the guy who thinks it sounds fine, thinks it sounds good. They're telling him, no, you don't think that. You don't know what you think. You're wrong about your own opinion about something. That's gaslighting. And information control, because they are preventing the guy who thinks his rig sounds good from influencing other people to think it sounds good. A group might even have a rule that you can't promote certain brands of gear, which would absolutely be information control. They are preventing their members from accessing certain information through that group. This could also hypothetically bleed over into thought control or emotion control. So this group on social media is telling people how to think about certain types of guitar gear. And as you said, the difference is small. Big things like what amp you have or what type of pickups you have on your guitar can make a difference to a really well-trained ear especially. But the way that you wire your pedal board just isn't going to make that much of a difference. But the group could be telling people what to think. They could be telling people that they can hear a difference in the way that a pedal board is wired from an iPhone video on the internet. The group can even be telling people what emotions they should be feeling about the sounds that they are hearing in this group. And if someone dissents and says that they think it sounds fine without whatever special gear or without the special wiring method or whatever, the group can jump down their throats and say that they're wrong, that they're not thinking correctly, they're not hearing what they think they are, or even that their emotions about this are inherently wrong.
I think that was very well put. I think guitar gear is a good example for this because, let's take like guitar effects pedals, for example. A guitar effects pedal is usually a thing that goes on the floor between a guitar and an amplifier, and it's about the size of like two decks of cards stacked on top of each other. And they usually cost about $100 normally. But for every like guitar effect that's made by a legacy brand, there's the other legacy brands that have done their version of that same effect. There's the somebody did a reimagined version. There's somebody did a modified version. There's somebody did a boutique version with components made from unobtainium and the and unicorn farts or some costs $400 instead of $100. And then there's going to be the Chinese knockoff for $40 that sounds exactly the same. People on the internet will say, oh, this sounds, it's got more brightness, it's got more color, and it's bull. But people will seriously get so into the reads on this, and it's like,
so the hypothetical that I just gave is a totally extreme example. I certainly don't think the vast majority of guitar gear groups on the internet come anywhere close to being a cult. But this hypothetical group that I made up and described absolutely does show some elements of cult control. And it's not completely impossible that a group based on consumption of a certain product could become a cult. And I think I've illustrated how that could be.
I mean, a lot of people who buy hella guitar gear are playing in worship bands. So if it's the right kind of church, it might be a cult.
That could be.
The thing is, nobody in the audience for a concert has ever said, man, this song is really good. I'm really enjoying this song. But if only the guitar player's pedals were all true bypass instead of buffered bypass, that's, it's just really ruining it for me. But like, I'm glad that you brought that up, because that is an example of getting validation online from other collectors or consumers can be a big part of this. And a lot of people will recommend that other people make the same purchases that they have made in order to validate their purchases.
Mm-hmm. So I think we can extrapolate from the hypothetical I gave how a group that is centered around a certain watch brand or car brand or a luxury handbag brand or even an activewear brand or a shoe brand or a makeup brand could hypothetically have some of the elements of coercive control, or under extreme and rare circumstances could potentially turn into a cult.
So the next two segments of the episode, I want to dive into some specific brand-based subcultures and how they can turn out to be culty.
Okay, let's do it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, Sadie here. If this is your first time listening to the Leaving Eden podcast, make sure you go back and check out episode 57. It's a primer episode for new listeners. That episode tells my personal story and gives you all the terms and information that you'll need to know going forward. Also, check out our cult true crime series, The First Family of Fundamentalism, so that you can get the whole cult story. If you like our show, you can support us by joining our Patreon, where we have extended and uncensored episodes as well as other bonus content available. You can also join in the discussion in our Facebook group. That group is called Eden Exodus. Tell a friend, tell a family member, tell your worst enemy. The Leaving Eden podcast is a fully independent podcast, and we really appreciate your support. Now, back to the show.
We are back from our break. We're talking, I guess, this segment, I'm going to talk about watches, and the next segment, Sadie's going to talk, you're going to talk about, like, skincare brands, right?
Yes.
Okay, this should be really interesting. I'm excited to hear what you have to say. But in this segment, I'm going to talk about watches. Out of curiosity, Sadie, do you know who the largest manufacturer of wristwatches is?
I do not know. I would take a wild guess and say maybe Timex.
Nope. The largest manufacturer of wristwatches is Apple.
Really?
Yep, it's Apple.
Okay, that does make sense because you and Jonathan are the only people that I know that wear watches that are not Apple watches.
Exactly, though. Like, that's the thing, is that if your watch isn't a smartwatch, it's jewelry.
Uh-huh.
And that's fine if you want to wear jewelry instead of, you know, a smartwatch or whatever, then that's absolutely fine. Or if you don't want to wear a watch at all, that's totally valid, totally okay. But essentially, the smartwatch has eclipsed the conventional watch in much the same way that, like, back in the 1970s, battery-powered quartz watches destroyed the market for mechanical wristwatches. Like, smartwatches are durable, functional, readable, inexpensive, and conventional watches, you know, mechanical watches especially, are harder to read. They're more fragile. They won't call emergency services if you fall and break your leg when you're out trail running. And a smartwatch usually costs like a couple $100s. And for that price, if you're like looking at buying mechanical watches, that's like the bottom of the bottom of the bottom rung when it comes to people who are serious about watch collecting. Watches that aren't smartwatches are jewelry. Can I tell a little industry story?
Yeah, absolutely.
So in the middle of the 20th century, watches were powered by, they're mechanically powered by spring tension. So you either had to wind them or they had ones with rotors inside that would wind themselves. They weren't powered by batteries. They weren't powered by electronics. The country of Switzerland was well known for its watchmaking, and whatever your needs were, there was a professional watch that was made for you. So if you were a professional diver, you could buy a Rolex Submariner, which was water resistant and it had hands that glowed in the dark. If you needed to time things, you could buy a watch like the Omega Speedmaster, which was selected for use in space by NASA and was famously used by Jim Lovell to time the 14 seconds of rocket burn that saved the astronauts on the failed Apollo 13 moon mission. Brands like Breitling would include features like a slide rule around the bezel of the watch that pilots could make calculations about airspeed and fuel on. Brands like Patek Philippe and Audemars Piguet and Vacheron Constantin were well known for making classy dress watches for formal occasions, often making pieces for those who were in high society, people like, you know, kings, queens. The idea was that if a watch was good enough for Queen Elizabeth or Neil Armstrong or Steve McQueen or Sir Edmund Hillary, then it was going to be good enough for you. But this all changed in 1969 when the Japanese watch manufacturer Seiko introduced a watch called the Astron, which was the first battery-powered wristwatch to be made available on the mass market. This battery-powered watch quickly made the entirety of the Swiss mechanical wristwatch industry obsolete, and many successful brands completely went under. The Swiss watch industry tried to compete with function by making their own battery-powered watches, but those didn't really take. Then the Swiss brand Audemars Piguet kind of cracked the model for the Swiss watch industry's success going forward. In 1972, they released a watch called the Royal Oak. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because your favorite rapper wears one. The Royal Oak was not made of exotic materials. It was made of steel. The Royal Oak did not have any special function or complication except for like a date display. The Royal Oak was less accurate than battery-powered watches. It was less reliable, and it had a striking design with an integrated bracelet that even led some to call it ugly. But the biggest feature of this watch was the $3,300 price tag, which, adjusted for inflation, $3,300 in 1972 is about $25,000 in today's money. For comparison, in 1972, you could buy a top-of-the-line Ford Mustang Mach 1 with the biggest, most powerful engine available for $3,300. So that's the kind of money that we're talking about, a brand new car. But this move essentially saved the entire Swiss watch industry as we know it, because other companies went and hired the Royal Oak's designer to get him to design similar watches so that they could try the same strategies. The industry basically went from competing on function and price to competing between manufacturers to see who could make the most like gauche, garish, and vulgar display of wealth. More recently, so they basically went from saying this is a company that makes things that are functional, like almost as like an appliance, to a company that makes jewelry. This is an industry that makes jewelry now. More recently, however, watch manufacturers have been going through their back catalog and taking styling and design cues from watches of yesteryear and really playing into their brand's heritage and, you know, saying, oh, this is a tool watch, things like that. And of course, one of the byproducts of doing this is using marketing and advertising copy that is emotional and evocative. And while people can certainly be emotional about a product or a brand because they have a personal history with the brand, there are some people who don't just like buy in. They like really buy in, and it can get very, very weird.
I'm interested to hear what the extent of somebody's buy-in can be for a watch brand.
Okay, so I have linked a blog post from Hodinkee.com. Hodinkee is a website that both brings a, like, that they blog about watches, they blog about the industry, they sell watches, watch-related accoutrement. The post that I've linked is from October of 2022, and it's a profile of a fashion podcaster named Jeremy Kirkland, in which he describes what his Rolex GMT Master II, colloquially, if you're in the know, is this watch is known as the Rolex Pepsi because it's got a blue and red bezel. But he's talking about what this watch means to him, and I'm going to read this quote right here. He says, "My wife went into labor, and we were getting ready to leave the house. And when we were in the driveway pulling out and her water broke, I realized I hadn't put on the watch, and I wanted to wear it when he was born. So I stopped the car, pulled back into the driveway, and she's asking me what's wrong. I just told her I left something important behind. And I went and got the watch and put it on, and she asks me, 'Did you just go inside to get your watch while I'm in labor right now?' Of course, that's exactly what happened. But by then, Kirkland had the watch and was able to wear it for the birth of his son." Sadie, I want to know your opinion on this as somebody who has gone through labor.
So I was induced, so it was not a time-sensitive labor. I'm not sure I have the full perspective. I can tell you for sure, if I were already in the hospital in labor and my partner left and went home to get something he forgot, I'd be pissed. Like, I don't care what you forgot. It doesn't matter. In this scenario, though, if he is telling us accurately, and that's a big if, they were barely out of the driveway. So it took him literally 5 seconds to throw the car back and drive, pull into the driveway, run into the house, get it, like 2 or 3 minutes in difference. How bad it was depends on how much pain his partner was in and how long the drive to the hospital was. This is not automatically like the worst thing anybody has ever done. There are a lot of variables here.
You're being far more lenient and compassionate than most of the people on the internet were. When this article came out, because I sometimes just like lurk in watch forums, this made it to all of the front page of all of like the cringe pages, all of the ones where this has gone too far. No, for me, it's not even like the, oh, I forgot my watch. It's the, I need to commemorate the birth of my child with a thing that I like that I purchased for the occasion. And not even just like, oh, well, my kid's born, so I bought a nice bottle of champagne. It's, I need to be wearing this watch that I like when my kid is born. That's weird to me.
So I see, here's the thing. The person who carries the pregnancy gets somewhere around 9 months, a little less, to bond with their baby. But the non-gestational partner doesn't get that. So for the person who's not carrying the baby, if there's a couple where one person is carrying the baby and the other person isn't, the person who's not carrying the baby, like the birth, is when they bond with the baby. And the birth can be a really, really big deal for the non-gestational parent. So to me, it totally makes sense that the guy wanted to have this thing that is really important to him on his body when he welcomes his child into the world. Jonathan wore a special Metallica shirt from when we had Chuck. He definitely like picked a specific band shirt and like wanted to wear that. On the other hand, I was induced, so he didn't have to like keep it ready or go back into the house to get it. We just had an appointment to go to the hospital and go have the baby. This guy in this story absolutely could have avoided this problem if he had just put the watch in the hospital bag or put it in the car or worn it all the time, starting at like 36, 37 weeks. So he definitely could have gotten out ahead of this one. I don't have a problem with him wanting to have the watch on when his kid was born. I think that's pretty normal for a non-gestational parent to want to do something special to bond during and after the birth of their child. He really should have been better prepared. And I would be ready to completely roast him. If he's not telling the story accurately, I change my opinion immediately. If they were 2 minutes away from the house and he pulled a U-turn to turn around, go back to the house, park in the driveway and go in the house and get it, I completely rescind my remarks. That is not acceptable. The only reason I think this is less of a really big bad deal is because they were literally in the driveway pulling out. Like, they were not even off their own property yet. And that makes me more willing to be compassionate.
Yeah. And that's fair. Saying I have a Metallica t-shirt that's like, what's a t-shirt? What's a Metallica t-shirt? Like $40 max? Something like that?
Yeah.
This watch is like $10,000. Saying I'm going to spend $10,000 on a watch to commemorate the birth of my child seems a bit like, okay there, buddy. It's also like, it's not the same for me as giving your kid the name of a character from a fandom, but I feel like it's giving your kid a fandom name adjacent.
I think it's fine for this guy. Like, he's a watch guy. That's what he's into. I think it's fine for him to want to wear this watch at the birth of his child. But as I said, if it comes out that he was literally one wheel out of the driveway, I change my opinion immediately.
Okay, I see your point there, but do you see where I'm coming from, where this can easily get extremely cringe?
Yes, well, we just had to spend like 10 minutes litigating exactly where this guy's wheels were in the driveway to discover whether we think he went over a line or not. So his behavior that I'm still feeling like is not that bad is so close to the edge of really extreme and not okay behavior.
Yeah, I just think it's weird that somebody would be so brand obsessed that they needed to incorporate their favorite brand into the... Anyway, if you're wondering how I know all this stuff, it's because during the pandemic, I, like many others, went down the watch collecting YouTube rabbit hole. It was recommended to me. I thought it was interesting, and I had a lot of time on my hands. And so while I personally didn't spend more than maybe a couple $100 on watches during the pandemic, and I was just like, I like having new packages arriving in the mail because I'm bored, other people who were flush with money either from the government or from investing in cryptocurrency, remember that? That was a fun time. They decided that the best thing that they could do with their money was start collecting Swiss watches. Around that time, manufacturing was mostly shut down or it was reduced, and supply was so reduced at the same time that as the demand was booming from all of the people who had crypto money, people who had been interested in watch collecting as a hobby for years and years and years, they now found themselves unable to purchase watches from dealers, and people who were able to get in with watch dealers started selling the watches that they purchased new in box for double or even triple the price that they paid. So there was a huge bubble going on. And collectors who were either obsessed with the brand or flush with crypto cash and clueless to the fact that this was clearly a bubble, they were happy paying it. So waiting for the bubble to burst would mean not being able to flex your watches on social media during the pandemic in order to show off wealth and convince other people to buy your cryptocurrency. What's more, watch dealers would start telling customers that they would only sell watches to customers if they also had a good relationship with that customer, which means, sure, I'll sell you a Rolex Submariner at MSRP, which is $10,000 or something, but you have to agree to buy $60,000 in diamonds for your wife on your next anniversary.
So you had to foster a relationship with a watch dealer, which means buying stuff from the watch dealer.
Yeah, I mean, luxury watch dealer, they're all jewelers, and they all also sell like diamonds, jewelry, stuff like that. But this kind of led to a very weird joke phenomenon. And if you go back onto watch collecting forums, and you go back about 2, 3, 4 years to like mid-pandemic, and you look at people's posts, you'll notice something, which is that every time somebody posts a picture of a brand new hard to get watch that they just purchased, like a Rolex Daytona or a Patek Philippe 5711, something like that, the top comment will always be some variation of, "Oh, I see you let your watch dealer have sex with your wife."
Ew.
I kid you not, it is a running joke that men are telling their wives to go have sex with watch dealers so that they will sell them a new watch at MSRP.
This feels very Jack Scop coded, and I am not a fan.
Oh, no.
Yeah, tell me you see your watches and your watch dealer is more human than your wife without telling me. Gross.
It's truly ludicrous. Like, but they're making fun of like the lengths to which that people would go. Like, there are tons of people who you would see talking about, you know, going to a watch dealer to buy a watch only to learn that the model that they want is out of stock, which, you know, that happens because they only make a limited number. And then they get offered a more expensive and less desirable model. Like the ones that are like have gold accents on them or the ones with diamonds on them are, rather than just being like straight stainless steel, are always less desirable, but they'll be more expensive. But they'll be more expensive. So it'll be somebody that will go into their watch dealer and they will spend $17,000 on a watch that they don't want instead of spending like $11,000 on a watch they do want. And I see men, and like it's always men, talking about how their fiance is threatening to leave them because they spent $20,000 on a watch right before their wedding, but she doesn't understand that his dealer called and offered him the opportunity to purchase a Sky Dweller at MSRP, and if he said no, then he would no longer be in line when the other watches that he wanted came in, so he had to, you know, keep agreeing to keep buying these watches, or he wouldn't get to keep buying them. Like, and she would be like threatening to leave him, and he would be like, "Please help me convince my wife that this is, or my fiance, that this is normal, that this is like just how it goes."
See, that strikes me as pretty culty.
Yes.
There are a couple different factors. Like, number one, the dehumanization of the wives and fiancés in these scenarios. Because I did not feel like the guy in the first story where he went back inside to get a house while his wife went back inside the house to get a watch while his wife was in labor, the way that he told that story didn't feel dehumanizing to me.
His wife was a character in the story that was just like, "Are you kidding me?"
She had a voice, you know, she had, and it is.
And at the end, he was just kind of like, "Yeah, I'm a dumbass for that, but whatever."
Yes. Like, but she, like, that character in his story feels like a real person. And in these jokes of, like, "I see you let your wife have sex with your watch, or told your wife to go have sex with your watch dealer," that is way more dehumanizing. Like, that's way more of a red flag to me.
It's legit a meme at this point. If you go in there, it's legit a meme.
Yeah, but that's a very misogynistic meme. And because,
no denying it,
and I shouldn't have to spell this out, but I'm going to because it got under my skin. You know, tell your wife to go have sex with somebody. Like, what are you? Are you her husband or are you her pimp? Come on. That really plays into really frustrating stereotypes of sex workers and also of husbands as owners of their wife's body. It also makes it out that she has absolutely no agency or no emotions in this, and that a woman is just a thing for somebody to have sex with, whether it's you or your watch dealer. Really hate that. Sorry, that may have triggered me a little bit.
I mean, it's a valid reason. Totally valid. But
no, it totally did, because I just immediately flashed back to Jack Scott saying he was going to put his wife out on the streets of Chicago in a fur and heels in the backseat of a Mercedes to raise the money for the new church building. And I think that's like the nerve that it touched.
deeply disrespectful.
But the thing is, dehumanizing a certain group of people, like wives or fiancés or women, is an element of cult control. That is, depending on what is being done with that dehumanization, it could be information control, it could be emotion control, it could be thought control. But that is an element of coercive control. I would particularly look at information control because it is separating people into in-group and out-group. In-group is smart men who want to spend a bunch of money on watches. Out-group is your wife or fiance who does not want you to. And that sets people up to accept the opinions of the in-group, all the other men who want to buy watches, and reject the opinions of the out-group, which is anybody who doesn't want you to buy more watches. Particularly women. But that could, you're absolutely right. It is absolutely, I don't want to be like, oh, everybody who is super into watches is in a cult. Because that's not accurate. And that's not the premise of this episode. But the premise of this episode is, here is how these things that are not cults could spiral into being cults. And I absolutely see it in the misogyny in these particular watch forums.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think that it's also a sense of, what are you willing to give up in order to get to give us money, in order to have the honor of giving us money?
That's the other thing I was going to say. Thank you for reminding me.
It's so, because that's the thing, is that like the watches, especially like the fancy ones, the Swiss, they're so much fucking money. It's like a ludicrous amount of money. Like, if I'm thinking, like, what is a expensive piece of jewelry that I would wear, is, I mean, I'm like, oh, if I spent $1,000 on something, that would be crazy. But people spend tens of thousands of dollars and then they just fucking walk around all day with that on their wrist. Like, you could get robbed, you could lose it, you could trip and fall and break it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have never had somebody spend that much money on jewelry for me, for sure.
And that would be horribly irresponsible if they had.
Yeah, no, I have some pieces that are heirlooms that are worth a little bit, not tens of thousands of dollars by any means, but I have some very nice pieces of heirloom jewelry, but nobody's ever spent that kind of money on me.
I mean, that would just be, but also that's not where your head's at either. You're not looking for somebody who's going to spend, like, I mean, for you, a $200 bag. Oh, that's a nice bag.
But I don't want those anymore, because I'm going to have Cheerio crumbs and hopefully maybe one day some baby spit up on everything I own and wear for, hopefully, let's cross our fingers and hope, hopefully the next 5 years or so. No, I know a lot of women who have very nice engagement rings. Things that are the main stone. I know in my generation, the halo look was super, super trendy. So they'll have the main stone that's a carat or even bigger, and they'll have the halo around it. And I know plenty of women that wear engagement rings that are worth between $5,000 and $15,000, and value that. And I don't think it's a problem to want something nice or to value something nice. But if I had one of those, I would never wear it, because I have my hands in, like, meatballs and bread dough all day long. It's not practical for me.
I'm thinking back to this past season of Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, when Lisa Barlow lost her $60,000 diamond ring in a toilet.
Oh, no. See, that's why I don't ever want to own a $60,000 ring, because that is exactly what would happen to me.
I know. And she was so they were on, like, vacation and stuff, and she lost her ring in the toilet, and it, like,
was it insured?
I don't know, but she was just, like, freaking out, and she's like, that was $60,000. John gave that to me. It was $60,000. It was a whole thing where people were like, what happened to it?
I can see this going. I don't think that buying watches is cult-like behavior, but you can see how, under the wrong circumstances, it could become so.
Yeah, and you could definitely f*** your life up by doing this. Yeah. You could f*** your finances up by doing this. Do you want to go to break and then come back? And then you could talk about skincare? Okay.
Let's do it.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
We are back from our break. Thank you guys for listening to me ramble on about watches.
Now it's time for you to listen to me ramble on about skincare.
That's interesting. I know very little about skincare. Please tell me.
So I recently noticed a phenomenon of consumerism that could potentially be seen as cult-like. And when we started writing this episode, I thought, oh, this is the perfect place to talk about this. And that is preteens' current obsession with Drunk Elephant skincare. Drunk Elephant is a skincare brand. It is originally marketed to like young millennials is what I would say the target demographic is.
Okay, so like late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, people right around my age. We first started to see this trend pop up before Christmas of last year, Christmas 2023. All of a sudden, it seemed like every preteen girl had this very expensive skincare brand on their Christmas list. We're talking products that are in line with most beauty brands, skincare brands that you would see, like Sephora or Ulta. They run around $50 for a single product. And that's not out of line for like the stuff that I buy. It's maybe a little more expensive than the stuff that I buy, but it's not that different. And these kids would be asking for three or four or more pieces from this skincare line, totaling up into hundreds of dollars.
Wow. So when we say preteen, it's like 10, 11, 12, 13, yeah. that age. Okay.
Yes. About 8 to 11, 8 to 12 years old.
Eight. That seems young to be.
Right. So that is what drew people's attention about this, because 12-year-old wants nice skincare stuff doesn't seem that crazy, but 8-year-old wants $50 skincare really doesn't seem normal.
So would I be wrong if I questioned the ethics of marketing skincare products to preteens, aside from like telling them to put on sunscreen?
No, not at all. But okay. Drunk Elephant didn't intend to market to preteens. They are a pretty standard, like I said, young millennial skincare brand that took off, gained popularity just before the pandemic at the height of that trend toward complicated skincare routines.
Oh, right. I remember, because people are watching the Get Ready With Me videos and they're like saying, I'm using this. I've seen these videos. People are at home during the pandemic. They're getting bored. And that's how you're making content if you're a content creator, is a Get Ready With Me. Okay.
So the Get Ready With Me videos are still alive and well in 2024. It was because of child influencers on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube Shorts doing these Get Ready With Me videos using Drunk Elephant products that other children, specifically preteen girls about 8 to 11 years old, became obsessed with these products.
So, child influencers is just seems like, no, please, no.
Mm-hmm.
Make it stop. Also, so can we talk about, like, so what is and what isn't appropriate skincare for an 8 to 11 to 12, 13-year-old?
We are going to get into this because the owner of Drunk Elephant sent out an email with her recommendations and saying, you know, a lot of our products are safe for very young skin, but these particular products are not. Having read a couple articles about this, specifically retinols and acids, including vitamin C, are not safe or necessary for children's skin. Dermatologists typically recommend that people not use retinols at all until after age 25.
Huh.
There's nothing wrong or harmful about an 8, 9, 10-year-old using a moisturizer or a face wash or getting in the habit of good skin cleaning routines or enjoying the luxury of using a nice cream on their face. There's nothing wrong with it, but typically we don't say their skin needs anything more than mild soap and sunscreen.
Yeah, I also get the feeling like, 'cause a lot of skincare products that are out now that I see advertised, they're very much advertised to try to prevent skin aging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it feels a little bit insane for like 10-year-old kids to be worried about, oh, is my skin aging? Do I look old?
Yes. And some of the most popular products that these kids were asking for were anti-aging products, which is clearly not necessary.
No, I also get the feeling that like a lot of the anti-aging skincare, it's almost like, you know how advertising, they can't really body shame people anymore. Like they can't fat shame people anymore.
Not without getting called out anyway.
Not without getting called out. Now, you know, advertisers are, you know, they're having people of different body types than would normally have been seen half a generation ago in their advertising. They're more representative. They're different colors of skin, different complexions, things like that. The people in the advertising are more representative of what the general population looks like than they used to be. But I also get the feeling that a lot of the anti-aging skincare is like, it's almost like a body positivity movement friendly way to neg people into buying stuff.
That's interesting. And I do really wonder what's going to happen with the buccal fat removal trend.
Oh, yeah. The buccal fat.
Buccal fat. Is that what it is? Is it buccal or buccal?
I've always heard buccal, but
I think we should look it up.
It's the thing where they like take the fat out from in your cheeks to make your face look thinner.
Oh, it is buccal. You're right.
It's buccal. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. So it's the fat right under your cheekbones. It's prominent in AFAB people, and you'll see that younger AFAB people have a very round face. My face has distinctly changed over the last few years. So as you age, that fat dissipates. It's one of the first face changes that comes with aging. I'm not speaking clearly because I'm poking my face as I talk, which is probably not helpful. But there is a trend of younger AFAB people in their early 20s having that fat surgically removed, and it gives a very sculpted appearance to a person's cheekbones and jawline, but it also makes someone look several years older. And I really wonder, in 10 more years, when the results of that have progressed 10 years on, what that's going to do to trends in plastic surgery, trends in makeup, all sorts of things.
Well, they'll just get fillers put in. That's what they'll do. They'll just inject fillers. That's, I mean, you sell somebody something that causes a problem, and then you sell them the solution to that. But like, it's, you get them coming and going. I mean, it's the same thing where like, I do see like the preventative Botox is very big right now. And I'm like, I look at that like, what the f-? Like, you're telling 24-year-olds you should get Botox in your face so that you don't age. Like, are people that terrified of getting one wrinkle in their face? It seems...
Yeah, I think the answer to that is yes.
That, to me, that, I mean, I don't, I, maybe people are just more in front of cameras than they've ever been before.
I think that's it. That some people, some plastic surgeons have said it's the Zoom effect. It's because of being on camera for a work meeting and having to look at your own face.
I mean, I guess I had to cope with the fact that my hair went away and I used to have hair like Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin and now I don't.
See, I think it just, it hit you young. You had to cope with it. It sucked for a little bit.
It literally,
I was there for that. I was your friend when you shaved your head the first time.
It was literally no fun. And it was literally years of me f-ing worrying about it. And then I finally shaved my head. Like, that's the thing, is that you kind of just have to accept that you're not going to look 22 forever.
Yeah. And you were really in pain.
I was upset about that because my hair was fantastic.
Well, like now you've, I think, gained so much confidence from that. And you're a lot more confident and well-rounded as a person. So I feel like I can poke fun at past you just the smallest amount. But you were genuinely upset. And I don't mean to demean that. You were really sad. And
people were, you know, and it, like all the time I was getting targeted advertisements saying, oh, here's products that will make your hair come back. And I would look into them and, you know, not purchase them because it turns out that they're fucking fake and they don't work, or they didn't work, or they weren't going to work for me. And I didn't want to spend all of the money, but I was literally getting targeted ads on my Instagram for like hair transplants. And they're just like, here's a $4,000 and you have to do a round trip to fucking Turkey and they'll Not kidding. Those were ads I was getting ads for not just hair transplants, but also just like, go to your doctor and see if you are need a hormone replacement therapy for low testosterone. So basically they're trying to fucking sell me steroids and hair transplants because they're like, oh, here's something that you're insecure about.
Yep.
And granted, I was a grown adult at that point. I wasn't a 10-year-old being with like anti-aging being marketed at me.
So we're going to unpack some of the cult-like and not cult-like pieces of this drunk elephant puzzle. So number one, something that is not a cause for concern, in my opinion, kids want what other kids have. Kids want the zebra cakes in the next kid over's lunchbox, and they want the cool trendy toy that their neighbor got for Christmas. This is the reason that every Christmas there is that one toy that every kid has on their Christmas list and every parent is desperately trying to locate, aka the plot of Jingle All the Way. Like, that is a thing because kids want what other kids have. They're learning how to be humans and humans want what other humans have. And that is, by the way, the good thing about having a February birthday. My birthday is like 45 days after Christmas. So I would just tell my parents to wait on whatever that super popular toy was every year. If I wanted that thing, I would just tell them to wait and catch the first restock after New Year's, and then I'd just get it for my birthday.
See, this is also why I like Southern and Midwestern people, because you can get them a fancy present and their response is always going to be, oh, you shouldn't have. Oh, that's so nice of you. And then you can straight up tell them, no, it's fine. It was on sale for 60% off. And they'll like be super fucking pumped. They'll be like, oh, you got it on discount? Hell yeah. Like that makes it even better.
Yeah. You know? If you're that kind of person and someone gets you a gift on sale, it's a feature, not a bug. I was talking about getting a Kate Spade wallet for Christmas. I told my mom that I wanted one and she texted me one day before Christmas, like, tell me what color you want. Tell me what style you want right now because they're on deep, deep sale. Like, go, 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 now, we gotta choose.
But that's a nice gift.
So it's not concerning for kids to want something that another kid wants, and it's not concerning for little kids to want to play pretend and pretend to be grown-ups. That's something that all kids do, whether they're rocking a baby doll, pretending to be a parent, or playing with a toy makeup kit, or a doctor kit, or a tool kit, or pretending to drive a dump truck. All of those things are normal things for kids to do. Kids pretend to be grown-ups. It is what kids do. So I try to be really intentional about the way I talk to my kid about anything related to beauty standards, because she does. She loves to play with my makeup. She wants to do it all the time. So I am not going to not let her, but I try to be really intentional about the way that I do it. I don't talk about my weight or size or other people's weight or size. I do talk to her, though, about makeup, skincare, shaving, bras, nail polish. She is super, super into nail polish and always wants it.
I mean, that's totally normal, though, for kids, because they're going to watch their parents and then copy what they do and how they behave.
Yeah. So I just try to be intentional about the way I talk about it. So, for example, I would not say to her, I need to put on makeup today because I look awful. I don't say that to her. I don't phrase it that way. I say, I think I'd like to wear some makeup today. I always try to frame all of those beauty standard type things as something that is totally optional, something that is not particularly gendered, and something that I do because it makes me feel good and because I want to. Little kids wanting to play grown up or use makeup or have a skincare routine is not necessary, but it's also not harmful or scary. Drunk Elephant has come out, as I mentioned earlier, and made it clear which products are okay for very young skin and warned parents away from any products containing acid, like even vitamin C and retinols, which are too harsh for kids' skin.
I'm just thinking about how times have changed, because when I was between the ages of 8 and 12, I wanted Bionicles.
But when I was between the age of 8 and 12, I wanted skincare. I just didn't know that there were expensive brands out there.
Were you getting like Walgreens brand?
Yeah, that apricot scrub that we all tore our skin off with for like 5 years. So I think, you know, wanting skincare or beauty products or something fashion or beauty related is pretty normal for 10 to 12 year old AFAB kids. And I don't think that Drunk Elephant kids are in a cult. But I think there are, on the other hand, some concerning signs that we actually do need to look at.
So I am concerned about what you've told me about this, because I mean, we all know kids love these unboxing videos. They like watching them on YouTube, on TikTok, whatever. And as I said earlier, like, one of the most surefire ways to get your video in front of the eyes of people, if you're creating content, is to put a dollar amount in either the title or the video thumbnail. No, I mean, I didn't grow up watching a lot of commercial TV except for sports, because my parents were like PBS only. But I know I grew up watching more commercials than Sadie did.
True.
And I know that other kids in my classmates, you know, that I had watched more commercials than I did. And I know that kids today are being advertised to more heavily than any of us ever were. I mean, we grew up watching more commercials than our parents did. And Generation Alpha is being advertised to more directly and at a younger age than we ever were. But I do think that the level of advertising that kids are getting exposed to, either through actual advertising or through product placement, is cause for concern.
Yeah. So I'm going to take what you just said one step further. You said that Generation Alpha is being advertised to more directly and at a younger age than we were. I agree with you, but I think this Drunk Elephant trend actually goes further than that. These were originally child influencers making these videos. These child influencers and the Drunk Elephant company claim that they were not paid advertisements. This is an example of a brand itself and consumption of the brand going viral, which is not a new thing, but it might be a new thing to have it happen to 8-year-olds.
That is very concerning. With everything that we know about kids who grew up in the camera, like in front of a camera, everything that we've talked about with the Duggars, you know, other family influencers, it's also like very much a, is my child safe from predators online issue?
Mm-hmm.
I really don't like this at all.
So I recommend following Caroline Isom over on TikTok if you want to learn more about child influencers. She is really getting into advocacy around this topic, and she's very well informed. But I think the Drunk Elephant trend is problematic in additional ways to just the child influencer question and advocating against child labor, which is so often performed by child influencers. And I think it's also different than a kid wanting a certain toy. There's another super trendy preteen and teen thing right now, which is Stanley Cups. Even older people can be into Stanley Cups. It's something that you have, you own, possibly you collect, and you use over and over and over. Skincare in particular is something that you buy not to own, but to use and to use up. And this particular brand is rather expensive. And it kind of doesn't hit me right that a kid that young is participating in a trend where the consumption of the thing rather than the ownership of the thing is the point of the trend. The other thing about like the consumption part of this trend is that young kids are going into Sephora and making what they call skincare smoothies by mixing things from multiple different testers and using up the testers in the store. And that's another way that the consumption of the thing is the point of this trend more than the ownership of the thing. And that's the first thing I find really concerning. The other thing is something I've seen happening with both Stanley Cups and Drunk Elephant, and happens to some groups of teens and preteens, but not all. So in some geographical and demographic groups of teens and preteens, Stanley Cups or Drunk Elephant skincare are trending the same way that Air Jordans were trending when you were in elementary school. The same familiar way that things just become trendy and then children want them and kids may feel pretty bummed out if they don't have them. All of that is a very normal part of childhood. You gotta learn. I will not always have all of the things that other people have, and it's okay for me to feel bummed out that I don't have the thing that other people have, but it doesn't contribute to my value as a person, and it's not okay for people to bully me if I don't have the thing. And if I have the thing that other people don't have and want, I shouldn't rub it in the face of people who don't have it, and I shouldn't bully people for not having it. That is a incredibly normal and needed childhood learning experience. Children are becoming adults, and these are skills and understanding that they desperately need to build so that they can be an adult who doesn't have the thing that they want and know how to cope with it, rather than going to buy it when they can't afford it and causing a problem for themselves. This can be uncomfortable for the kids experiencing not having the thing that they want, or it can be uncomfortable for the grown-ups who are either trying to find the money to pay for the thing that the kid wants or explain to the kid why they won't be paying for the thing that the kid wants. But all of this is normal, and I would argue healthy to a kid's development. However, in other groups that I have heard about, mostly from other parents who have preteen children right now, I have heard about this from multiple different friends and family members who actually have kids in this demographic in school. Stanley Cups and Drunk Elephant are not trending the way that Air Jordans were trending when you were in elementary school. In some groups, we are seeing kids get bullied for showing up to school with a knockoff Stanley. And the message, the way that these particular kids are thinking about this thing is, you're better off not drinking water if it's not in a Stanley, or you're better off not using skincare if it's not Drunk Elephant. Nothing else is good enough. No substitutions.
And there was an episode of Atlanta with this exact plot line.
Well, because this isn't new in terms of kid trends, is it?
No.
I'm sure that somewhere in our age group, there were kids who got bullied for showing up to school in knockoff Air Jordans, or for not having Air Jordans, right? Surely that happened. The extra step that I'm seeing that's concerning me with Drunk Elephant is the messaging wasn't, you're better off not wearing shoes at all if they aren't Air Jordans. The message was, you're a loser if you don't have them, or I'm going to pick on you if you don't have them, or what are you, poor, or whatever, right? But the message wasn't, why are you even wearing shoes at all? And that idea of it is this product or nothing, no substitutions, really brings to mind some elements of the Bite model as that we were talking about earlier.
you know, don't even bother driving to the store in your Kia because it's not a Ferrari.
To me, this really seems like black and white thinking, which is a major component of information control.
So when I was in college, major was marketing adjacent, and a lot of people from my department ended up going into marketing after college, and I would be really interested in doing a deep dive on specific marketing campaigns, especially the way that things are, you know, viral marketing on TikTok, things like that. Do you think that thought control and emotion control are aspects of this sort of thing as well?
I think they absolutely can be. So the thing about this that makes it concerning to me is the element of nothing else being good enough. To me, that feels like it's not leaving room for independent thought, which makes me start to turn the wheels in my brain about thought control and emotion control. Are people feeling their own feelings, or are they being told what to think and feel? I wonder if there is a preteen out there who is into skincare, interested in it the way that their peers are, but genuinely thinks that Glow Recipe is a better brand. Or like me, I like the brand The Ordinary for skincare, and the products from that line really work for me, but they're like $6 to $16 a bottle, not $45 to $70 a bottle. So I kind of, that's great.
I am just continuously flabbergasted at the prices that these things cost.
I have, my sunscreen is expensive and my face wash is expensive, but my moisturizer is drugstore dirt cheap. So it makes me wonder if there is a preteen out there who is into the science of skincare and has built their own routine with other brands, and then is being told that they are thinking wrong or feeling wrong about these products because they think this other brand is great and they don't think they need Drunk Elephant. This is nowhere near enough evidence, in my opinion, to call it a cult. But I think there's enough here to say, hey, maybe this environment is fertile ground for cult-like thinking and cult-like methods of control, and we should keep an eye on it. There are some reasons for concern.
I have to wonder, so where are the kids getting all of the money to buy these things? When I was in middle school, my allowance was probably $7 a week, and it got bumped up to like 20 when I was in high school, so I could go out to get like pizza at lunch a couple of times.
So apparently they're asking parents to get it for them for like their big Christmas present.
This is a skincare product rather than like a new, I don't know, or not like a new video game or like a Lego set, or people have different skincare needs, especially from the ages of 10 to 13. There's a lot of variation in what your skin looks like.
And putting everyone into a box based on a brand that's popular has an element of behavior control. Telling, when you tell everyone there is one solution that fits everybody, that's behavior control, and it's also information control. Again, I do not think Drunk Elephant is a cult, but these are the reasons that I find it a little concerning.
I mean, I guess like the peer pressure around brands is definitely culty, is I guess what we're talking about here. Another question. How would your classmates know what brand of skincare product you were using if you're applying it at home?
I think kids text. I think kids, like little kids, FaceTime. I think little kids have phones and would be able to show each other what they have at home.
Man, this is...
But I'm not sure. Man, that made me feel old.
No, I do think that we should come up with a word or something for something that does like 3 out of 4 on the bite model. But not all of them.
I will often say cult-like, but that's not a great word for audio content because it can come out as cult-lite and be otherwise ambiguous. Everything that we've been talking about in this episode could be applied to a lot of other products that we haven't talked about. I know that I've been in groups online for brands of shoes or leggings or skincare or makeup that just felt the tiniest little bit culty. I've seen it happen with brands of cars, with kids' clothes brands, with kids' toys brands like Nugget, right? Brands of coffee makers. I think it's really rare for an online group like this based around consumption or ownership of a product to be a cult. But as I said up at the top, it's worth looking into the elements of coercive control that could potentially crop up in a group like this. I think we see the groups that we're in that are based on shopping or consumption as something similar to entertainment. I know I do. My shopping groups are an entertainment thing for me. Like, considering, even if I'm very rarely purchase anything related to that group, thinking about purchasing the thing, or thinking about which thing I would purchase, or thinking about which thing I'd like to save my money and purchase, is my brain treats that as entertainment. And I think if that's how your brain tends to treat these groups, you're probably not looking out for coercive control there. You're not on guard. I'm not on guard. And I think it's important to teach how to look out for these elements of coercive control, so that there is a little red flag going up in your brain, so that there is a little bell dinging in your brain when something goes wrong. I would even say something lower stakes like this, like a skincare group or a leggings group or whatever. I don't think there's anything wrong with being in a group that has some elements of coercive control. I just want people to be able to recognize them for what they are. I want people to make a habit of watching for these elements of control, so that when they do find themselves in a higher stakes situation, when they do find themselves with a group that might even be a cult, they are in the habit of watching for these elements of control and can recognize them quickly and protect themselves.
That was very well put. Thank you for that. And I think that's about all we have for our episode today. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. You guys have a great day. My name is Gavriel Hacohen. You can follow me on social media, is at GavrielHacohen on Facebook and Instagram. You can follow the podcast on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok at Leaving Eden Podcast. Sadie, your socials.
You can follow me on Instagram at Sadie Carpenter Music and on TikTok at Sadie Carpenter 1.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in. You guys have a great day. Bye-bye.